Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Soleil Ho has traveled and tasted the world, but from Minneapolis to Mexico, the Chicago-born chef, food writer, and podcaster never lost touch with her roots, always returning to the savory Vietnamese noodle soup she grew up with.
That speaks to something that is essential to us in our history that we just can't lose. It speaks to the strength of our identity. I mean, no matter who we are in my family, it all comes back to pho.
Soleil Ho has spent her career exploring big ideas about culture, memory, and race. And now her highest profile gig to date, restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And she's using this platform to push restaurant criticism forward, beyond the sunglasses and wig-wearing mystique of the all-powerful critic, beyond the dish, really, and to the issues that food can encompass: class, the environment, culture, even urban development. This hour on Point, Beyond the Plate with Soleil Ho. And you can join us. What do you want from a modern-day restaurant review? If food connects us so much to how we live, why shouldn't restaurant critics also write about, say, the skyrocketing rent prices that restaurant workers and owners face? Or is something lost when the focus goes beyond the craft and artistry of making an exquisite meal? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, joining us today from St. Paul, Minnesota, is Soleil Ho. She is the incoming restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. She's going to start that next month. She's also host of the podcasts Racist Sandwich and Propaganda, and author of the graphic novel Meal. Soleil Ho, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
It's great to have you. How excited or how much are you looking forward to taking up the helm as restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle?
I'm really thrilled. I never dreamed that I would ever have a position like this, so I'm so excited.
And you're not a Bay Area native at all, by any means. Have you ever lived there?
No, I haven't. I never had a tech job, so.
Okay, so you're a newbie. But you're bringing a fresh set of eyes, though, to a very foodie city. So what are the kinds of things that drew you to this opportunity that you'd like to do there?
Oh, man, I think. So one thing that's really interesting is that the Bay Area represents the Racist Sandwich's biggest audience regionally. And so after we noticed that on our Google Analytics stats, right, we became really interested in what was going on in the Bay Area. And of course, historically, they have had these big conversations about food and politics for decades, right? Alice Waters was a really big figure
right.
in that. And so I think this was a really natural place to continue doing what I do and focusing on the sort of themes and areas I really enjoy and love.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am really intrigued by this idea that intrigued isn't the right word. I think it's time has come that we recognize through food criticism how food does connect so many of the big issues that we're all grappling with in this day and age. So but tell us, where and when did your sort of fascination, relationship, love of food, when did that start? Where did it come from?
Well, it started from when I was a kid, when I was in grade school. I grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn, and Manhattan sometimes. And I would read New York Magazine all the time. My mom was always a subscriber, and I would read the food section religiously and look at all of the listings, you know, all the little blurbs about all the restaurants in the area, and just kind of read them one by one. And I was so fascinated by cuisine and all of the new and exciting things that were happening around me.
Okay, so tell us more. What was the food culture like in your house growing up?
Oh yeah, so my family is Vietnamese, but my mom has most often been a single working mother, and she would often order a delivery for us to eat because that was just the easiest, that was the fastest. In New York, even McDonald's delivers, right? So it's just really, really easy. The number is burned into my head, actually, for McDonald's delivery. And she would fan out the menus after school and ask my sister and I to just pick whatever we wanted to eat out of Indian, Thai, Vietnamese, Chinese, Mexican, French. And so, you know, every day was something new. And I always tried to get something new on the menu.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And you've written about how your grandparents, especially your grandmother, her her, sounds like, tremendous skill with Vietnamese food was also very much a part of sort of your food life growing up.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, my family always ate at my grandparents' house, and my grandmother's cooking is such a huge part of my childhood memories, which I think applies to a lot of people in this world. And, you know, in our particular case, that was Vietnamese food, and that was also like Cantonese Vietnamese influence as well.
Well, so can you tell us a little bit about what she made and why it was so important to you?
Oh, yeah. So she would often make pho. And, you know, when I was a really little kid, I was extremely picky. So it would just be noodles and broth and nothing else. So I was a purist in that way. And, you know, they would make jjayal, which is the spring rolls, and goikun. And we would all make the summer rolls together at the table, that sort of thing. And, you know, for me, that was my entree into Vietnamese identity, was actually tasting the food and growing up with the food and gaining that palate through having things that were, you know, full of fish sauce and fresh herbs and, you know, those textures. And that's, you know, that was my first encounter with Vietnam. I'd only gone there, I think, when I was 15 for a visit. And so that was how I experienced our heritage.
Okay. So this is something I'd love to explore a little bit more with you, because I think what you just described is very familiar to a lot of people, that the connection to, you know, whatever their family heritage is came through cuisine and came through food. But you've also written about how growing up as a young Asian American, that you felt at times that sort of set you apart, right? That there was, I don't want to call it a downside to that, but, you know, given the issues of race and culture in America, that it was challenging at times.
Yeah, I find that food is often a mode through which people can bully you as well. And so people would ask me if I ate dog, for instance, right? Which is like a stereotype of people in Southeast Asia and East Asia. And, you know, I would be like, no, of course not. But of course, like, people do. Like, that was this whole thing. But I just didn't have the nuance, you know, at 10 years old to understand like what it meant and why they were accusing me of eating pets. And, you know, there are other things as well. When people had really good intentions, you know, I think in college around like the 2000s, people started reacting to me revealing that I was Vietnamese by saying, oh yeah, pho, that's awesome. And I'm like, well, there's more to it than that.
And so I'm just trying to get a better understanding, especially for people who don't know your work already, sort of how all of these experiences and influences come together in the direction that you headed, because you ended up, you're a trained chef as well.
Yes, yeah. I am. I didn't go to culinary school,
okay.
But after I graduated from college, I got jobs in kitchens starting in Minneapolis. And so I worked my way through the back of house as a cook, line cook, garmanger, and then sous chef, then chef over the past decade.
Okay, so then you get to actually push back on any criticism that people might have that, you know, critics never actually have done what they're writing about.
Right, yeah. I think I'm very similar to my colleague, food writer John Birdsall, who's also a veteran of kitchens in California. And, you know, I think our perspective is very much informed by that and by knowing how things work behind the scenes.
Okay. Well, so then about what food critics and food criticism in America. I mean, I think that just at first glance, people often think that – so this is a world of very – you know, an elite world of high-minded folks who may only focus on the top restaurants in the city that they're in. Is that a fair analysis of what food criticism has been thus far?
I think so. I think the idea of newsworthiness has had that sort of air to it as far as food criticism goes, yeah.
Okay. And so then – but then it seems as if it's leaving open this giant swath of issues and ideas to wrestle with. I mean, why do you think that hasn't been done so far?
You know, I think the audience – for food media has broadened in the past few years. You know, it's not just something that the elites would read, for instance. Like, I think especially with Instagram and, of course, social media and, you know, food porn and all of that stuff, a lot of people engage with food as a leisure topic and as a leisure activity. And so they're interested in food criticism. And, of course, Yelp has also democratized it, you know, for good and bad. And, you know, a lot more people are interested in that apparatus and that entire mode of aesthetic criticism.
Right. So this is really interesting because this is you're also coming to the San Francisco Chronicle at a time where, as you just said, because of social media, because of things like Yelp, because of like the innumerable food shows that we have right now, I think people have a greater access to telling different kinds of stories about food than they have before. But nevertheless, I'm really fascinated by it seems as if you want to talk about things such as wealth disparities in a city, and San Francisco is a perfect place to have that discussion. I mean, how do you imagine tackling that subject through a restaurant review?
Well, I think it all. I think the premise of introducing politics into food criticism is really funny because I think the opposite is of politics less criticism is also very political, right? Like its absence. The absence of politics is a political choice as well. Mm-hmm. And so really, I'm just talking about things that have always been present. I don't expect to be didactic. And I don't want to write these long like scrawls, right, about the housing crisis. But it all factors in. It all matters. Like the fact that a restaurant cannot find people to cook the food consistently because they can't rent an apartment near the restaurant really matters, right?
Yeah.
That's part of the whole story.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think San Francisco is an amazing place to explore that because we'll come back from a break and talk more about that, given the incredible disparities that we see emerging for some time now in San Francisco. But I'm speaking this hour with Soleil Ho. She's the incoming restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle and host of the podcast Racist Sandwich and Propaganda, also author of the graphic novel Meal. And we're talking about a new generation or a new take on food and restaurant criticism, and whether it's high time that when we talk about food and write about food, we're also thinking about issues of race, of class, of culture, of even urban development. We'll have a lot more when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Soleil Ho. She's the incoming restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, host of the podcast Racist Sandwich and Propaganda, and author of the graphic novel Meal. And we're talking to her because she's bringing a new kind of restaurant criticism to a major American newspaper, one that's going to also take a look at issues of race and culture and history, everything from urban development, issues of the environment. So really taking the review beyond the plate itself. I mean, food is really the thing that binds so many aspects of how we live. Isn't it high time that restaurant criticism take into account issues, as we've been saying, of race, culture, history, economics, the environment? So before I want to play a bit of tape from your podcast, Racist Sandwich. But before I do, the name. Can you explain the name Racist Sandwich to us?
Yeah, it's a pretty funny one. My co-host Zahir John Muhammad came up with it, and I resisted for a long time, but it's actually perfect. So I got egg on my face about it. So it's it refers to this really interesting story that went viral of, in the Portland public school system, where a school administrator was doing a sort of sensitivity training with other school staff and talking about implicit bias. And so she used the example of, like, if you're a math teacher and you're using math problems, right, you're using a word problem and you say, you know, Matthew has 4 peanut butter sandwiches, yada, 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 right? Her point was, don't assume your students know what a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is, because they might not. They might not have ever eaten it before. So, you know, in that way, don't assume. Think about the demographics of your classroom and so on, right? Like, it makes sense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that story was leaked to, I think, Huffington Post or something, and it blew up into this huge thing where she was calling peanut butter and jelly sandwiches racist. And then the conservative media picked up on it and said, oh, like, Portland Public Schools spent millions of dollars to figure out that the peanut butter sandwich is a racist sandwich. And so the name comes from that whole idea where, like, the indignation of thinking about food as political just makes people... just blow up.
Oh, interesting. Okay. But as you were saying earlier, though, there food is kind of, is political, and the choice not to talk about politics surrounding food is also a political choice. You were just saying that, right?
Right. Yeah, that's the joke.
Okay. Well, so here's a clip from the podcast, Racist Sandwich. This is from the 2016 episode where you spoke with comedian Jenny Yang about community and culture.
For us, as immigrants or children of immigrants, food is one of the only places that we can usually keep, regardless of whether or not we speak our language, our native tongue, whether or not we get along with our parents, despite the immigration or refugee or cultural gulf. Right? Food is one of the only things that we have left that we could still use to communicate our love and to feel like we have a sense of identity and connection.
That's Jenny Yang speaking with Soleil Ho in 2016. So Soleil, tell us more about this, about food being, I mean, I think you've written about it too in your own life, one of the final places where communication, identity, and connection with a person's cultural past, that's one of the final places it remains.
Right, yeah. So for me, that was my first entree, right, was thinking about how it connected me with my refugee family. If we didn't have that, I don't know what we would really be able to talk about, because there's so much that's left unsaid about the refugee story that, you know, people aren't willing to tell their kids, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's really hard to have those really heart-to-heart conversations because there's so much trauma wrapped up into it. But food is really easy, right? It's a really easy topic of conversation. It's something that makes you happy and you can just gather around. And so, you know, that idea extends into all these other modes of identification where, you know, people do identify and they do group up around foods and food likes and dislikes. And it is very political, right? Like, you think about mayonnaise as sort of this, like, shorthand for, like, bland Midwestern food. Or, you know, you think of, chili on spaghetti as, like, this identifier for, like, people from Cincinnati, right?
Yeah.
It's very much tied into identity.
Yeah, interesting. And I mean, so speaking of being tied into identity or ways that people might identify someone else, I mean, you had a terrific article once where you wrote about cheese and cheese being a big, like, class identifier in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I wrote that with a friend, Erica Carson, and, you know, she grew up eating the sort of not government cheese, but, like, Easy Cheese and Cheese Whip and all of that stuff. And, you know, I grew up in New York and, you know, really fond of, like, the New York cheddars and all of that stuff. And we realized that through talking, there was a lot of class stuff mired in cheese knowledge, you know. I think of that really iconic Boondocks episode where, and I think, I don't know if it's referenced in the final draft, but it was definitely in the first draft, about how, you know, the characters who are African-American, they satisfy their white landlord by giving him a cheese plate, because that's like, oh yeah, white people love cheese. And so, like, that was really interesting to me at first when I was a kid and I saw that. I was like, oh, it's like, it's this total thing. Like, it's code switching, right? To, like, say that you know cheese and you know cheese, I know cheese, we can talk, you know? Like, yeah. So that was so fascinating and fun to write about.
Wow. I'll just say personally, as a non-white person, I too love cheese. Unfortunately, I'm not lactose intolerant. But anyway, so look, we've got a lot of people who want to talk to you. So let me let some of them in here. We're speaking with Soleil Ho. She's the incoming restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Really going to be one of the people in the vanguard of bringing a new kind of restaurant criticism to American newspapers and the rest of us in terms of how we think about food. So let's go to Matt, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's your question for Soleil?
Well, I actually just wanted to say I come from an interesting perspective. I went to school for agriculture, but got into the kitchen when I realized I don't have the money to open a farm. And it gravitated to the point where I entered the Michelin world. And, you know, there's a lot of politics in kitchens right now. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about the culinary world that I'm not really hearing at all. Like, there's lawsuits going on in New York in regards to, you know, employers not paying their work enough. And, you know, I signed a contract when I went to the Michelin world to work for free. And, you know, nobody ever talks about those kind of things. We hear about racist sandwiches and whether the fact what color you are determines how much you like cheese. You know, there's a lot to be said about the fact that the culinary culture is on the rise in this country. You know, Dominique Crenn is the first woman in the United States to be awarded 3 Michelin stars. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear, you know, more about the culture of working in kitchens. I'd like to hear about more about food itself. You know,
yeah.
If this is the direction that food reviews are going in, it's sad.
Well, Matt, thank you actually so much for your call. Soleil Ho, would you like to respond to Matt?
Yeah. So I'm definitely really fascinated by the kind of dynamics that happen in kitchens. As someone who's worked in kitchens myself, I read a really interesting review by Pete Wells recently on the Four Seasons in New York, in the New York Times. And, you know, if you don't know, if you're listening, and one of the founders or one of the owners was in the lawsuit right now about assaulting patrons. I think there was one particular one who sued him and just has a history of sexual harassment in the restaurant. And, you know, as a food critic, how do you write about that? Because that's a really interesting ethical quandary, right? Like, how do you criticize a restaurant based on its food while also acknowledging that, like, you know, if you praise it, you are putting money ostensibly into the pockets of someone who, you know, may profit off of this place as their hunting ground, right? Mm. And so he had a really interesting spin on it where he spent a few paragraphs just talking about that case and thinking about it in terms of, like, how does that affect your enjoyment of the place? Because, you know, it's really hard to go in there ignorant, right? You pay attention to the news, you know. And that was really fascinating to me. And I think this is an internal conversation that a lot of critics are having these days, especially, you know, post-Me Too. You know, like, as someone who is a woman of color and has worked in restaurants, I've experienced a lot of really weird stuff, too. And I still don't really know how to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Dominic, who's calling from Aspen, Colorado. Dominic, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. So like, I was going to ask you a question about so many food reviews are so concentrated or so Michelin star centric that the real value kind of disappears as far as what the consumer or the reader would want to find out. I mean, because certain things are, I mean, of course, critical, like the quality of the food. But there's other things that go into the perfect dining situation, like ambiance. Are you going to be talking about, you know, the ambiance, the whole experience of the food and the things that go along with it? Particularly, I find that, you know, the many people, and I'm a vice president of a chain of restaurants called Chart House, and we have really issues with some clientele that come in, and people are trying to have a great meal, and they end up ruining it for everyone, and that's really, you know, it's a shame, and yeah. Usually it's
Dominic, can I just jump in here for a second? I'm a little confused about you have issues with clientele ruining it for everyone else. I didn't understand what you meant by that.
Well, I mean, it's normally black people that do that. They ruin the meal for everyone.
Wait, hang on for a second, Dominic. You're saying with you have that African Americans are ruining meals for everybody else in your restaurant?
Well, they're not from Africa. They're black, so.
Okay. Dominic, thanks for your call, I guess. Soleil, I did not see that one coming. I want to be perfectly honest. I don't know where Dominic is coming from here. So my apologies for that. But let's go to a different caller. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have sons who both work in restaurants in different areas and different. One of them is a cook, and I have listened to them for years talk about the environment, from like premier restaurants to fast food, and how abusive managers are, how low pay they make, how
Anne, you still there? Looks like we lost Anne. Okay, so Soleil, let me go back to the overt racism that our previous, our penultimate caller had there. Let's talk about food and race here for a second. I mean, we just heard the vice president of a seafood chain say that African Americans ruin the experience for other people in the store. I mean, I was personally very shocked by that. Again, I apologize that made it on the air. But, you know, some of your thoughts about restaurants, food, racism, how do you wrap your head around that?
Well, I guess first off, when a lot of people have accused us of making things up, and thankfully there's proof right there that there is a lot to talk about, and we are not making a big deal out of nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I will say that, you know, that's, you know, actually to address the question about ambiance, is that a restaurant's management's attitude towards people of color is part of the ambiance, too. If you feel like you're being treated differently, or if you observe people being treated differently because of their race or gender presentation or sexuality or whatever, that matters, too, to the experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the people I'm writing for as well. Like, they have been sort of shut out of these conversations because, you know, their experience just didn't matter for a long time. And, you know, if there is a history of overt racism in a restaurant, then that's worth talking about. That is actually worth noting, because you don't want someone to walk into a place and experience discrimination and be like, what? Like, no one said anything about this. How, you know, like, why didn't I know about this? Like, it is worth talking about.
Yeah. And so then tell me, in how... how are you going to... Sorry, if I sound a little flustered here, it's because I'm really put off by what that caller said. I'm just going to put it out there. And again, I know I shouldn't be shocked, but sometimes it gets to me. But when you're doing your reviews starting next month for the Chronicle, for the San Francisco Chronicle, another thing to ask is there are so many restaurants below those Michelin starred ones that most of us will never even get to go to, let alone be able to afford.
Right.
And those other restaurants are the ones that give us entree into different cultures, different food histories, different groups in any city. Like, how are you going to go about choosing which one of those restaurants to feature in what could be a make or break review in the paper?
Well, I mean, I think about context a lot. And I think about sort of my predecessors, Jonathan Gold, Anthony Bourdain, for instance, who really understood how to talk with and write about and discuss food from communities they weren't from. I think Jonathan Gold is so influential in the way I think about restaurant reviews as well, in that, like, it's about celebration. It's about understanding the context of the people and the food and where they're from, and really just going headlong into something that is probably really unfamiliar with enthusiasm. And then people are going to pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if a place, a mom and pop,
doesn't impress me or just gives me a really bad experience, I'm just probably not going to write about them, because the impact of me writing a pan on them versus me writing a pan on Atelier Crène, right? It would be right. So disparate and so different. And I just, yeah, I'm not in this to shut down restaurants.
Right. You know, we have a comment here online, though, from someone calling themselves Jaso Turner, who says, I really like reading restaurant reviews. Some really read like art criticism, and you get to wondering about all the great stuff that expert chefs come up with. Others can be hysterically funny when they don't pull punches on failed efforts. But I'm hearing you say that you would pull your punches for a mom and pop that you don't really love.
Right. I mean, of course, you know, I do not hesitate to criticize. That's kind of part of the job, right? Like, the metaphor that I really like is I care a lot about this industry, and I will say something if something is wrong, because you don't want to have your friend walking around with spinach in her teeth, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you want us all to be better.
Yeah. Well, we're talking with Soleil Ho. She's the incoming restaurant critic at the San Francisco Chronicle, host of the podcasts Racist Sandwich and Propaganda, and author of the graphic novel Meal. And we're talking about a new kind of restaurant and food criticism, one that also takes into account issues of class, of race, of urban development, of the environment, the economy, because food connects us to all those things as well. We'll have a lot more when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Soleil Ho. She is the incoming restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and really bringing a new kind of restaurant criticism to the pages of a major American newspaper, one that's going to take into account issues of race, of the economy, of labor, of urban development, all of it, because food connects us to all of that. So, Soleil, I have to tell you that caller that we had in the last segment, who called himself Dominic from Aspen, Colorado, he claimed to be the manager or vice president of the Chart House seafood chain. We can't verify that, but that's what he claimed. But just to remind folks, he said that he felt that African-Americans frequently ruined the dining experience for other diners here. So, Leigh, that's really hit a nerve with a lot of folks here. On Twitter, someone sent us a tweet. Scott in the 603 says, Meghna, why did you not keep the discussion going with the VP of racism? An incredible opportunity to shine a light on what black people face every day in the USA. Call him back. Scott, I'm afraid we're not going to call him back because, quite frankly, we can keep the discussion going about racism in the food world and in America, but I don't necessarily want to give someone who has an overtly racist take on things any more airtime. Okay, so Scott, that's why we're not calling him back. We've got someone else here saying, race in restaurants. I worked as a waiter years ago and would treat people of color with respect, but a lot of waiters didn't even want them seated in their section. Soleil, just help us through this a little bit more. Like you said, there is something to talk about here. How do we continue this discussion? Should I call him back? I'm not going to, but like, would you?
Please don't call him back. Yeah. I mean, there's been these really huge cases, right, historically, at least in the U.S. and Canada, about this sort of treatment and anti-blackness in restaurants. You know, Denny's had a huge blow up and like a huge PR disaster because it was revealed that like black folks were systemically discriminated against in their restaurants. And of course, there's a whole thing, ROC United, which is the Restaurant Opportunity Center in New York, just did a huge study a few years ago about
disparities in economic and job mobility for people of color in restaurants. And so there's a lot that's going on. Like, they call it, like, segregated. Like, restaurants are segregated because, you know, folks who are, especially women of color, who make up the bulk of restaurant workers kind of stay in fast food. They don't really get opportunities in the front of house to represent a restaurant, to, you know, work at the front of a Michelin-starred restaurant, for instance. Like, that's really rare. And, you know, there's a lot to talk about there as far as how these racial categories get calcified in this world, which we believe to be a meritocracy.
Yeah. Well, let's go to John, who's calling from West Lebanon, New Hampshire. John, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, my thought was simply, I felt terribly to hear you get flustered. I wanted to encourage you to maybe let him resolve his own issues, because if his ignorance is obviously so strong that he's willing to portray himself so clearly on public radio to give his name, his location, and his business chain name, I think this problem can resolve itself.
Yeah. Well, you know what, John? You're very compassionate to feel badly for me, and I appreciate that, but you don't necessarily need to. I feel like I could have handled the moment a lot better, to be perfectly honest. But you know what? On live radio, you get it, warts and all. So thank you so much for your call, John. Let's switch gears here and go to Dominic, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Dominic, you're on the air. What's your question for Solejo?
Hi. You were talking about Jonathan Gold a little bit ago. But he was really, at least, you know, I'm from Los Angeles, also lived there a bunch of the time of my life. And he was really famous for not doing a lot of negative reviews. He had done a few, and those were based around a lot of the issues that I think you're kind of concerned with. The negative reviews that he did give were about restaurants that maybe didn't fit a neighborhood or were outside of the economic scope of the people around them. But I was wondering, If you have a highest moral value in your talking about restaurants or food, like if the taste of the food or the quality of a thing trumps the making of it or how it's made or who makes it, and also how do you choose the restaurants or the places or the food that you'll be talking about?
Yeah. Dominic, thanks so much for your call. Soleil, what do you say?
So I guess as far as the highest value or moral value, as you put it, in the end, my job is to tell us a reader or a potential patron if they'll receive good service, if they will actually get the bang for their buck, or, you know, if they will have a good time, you know, in the end, that's what matters. For me, those categories, though, are very stretchy, and you can stretch them in all kinds of different directions, right? Who is the patron? What do they actually look like? What's their life experience? For a long time, that's been really that's been really made into a sort of objective average, which, you know, I use with very, like, strong air quotes, right? Like, who is that person? Who is my reader? And so kind of stretching the definition of that, like, you know, how would an African-American patron fare at the Chart House in Colorado? That matters, too. As far as what restaurants I would choose, I've gotten so many suggestions from readers of the Chronicle and from my colleagues at the Chronicle as well. So I'm just going to make my way through the list.
I'm sure that
it's a long one already.
I was going to say that there's so many restaurants out there. It's likely to be an almost endless list. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, and congratulations to your guest. I was struck by a comment she made a little earlier in the program about how she had gotten some flack for, you know, she came from a culture where people eat dogs. And that got me to thinking, it's like, there's really no difference between eating a dog or eating a pig or eating a cow. And I wonder if your guest sees a place, excuse me, for a more enlightened restaurant critic to direct people to be more mindful in how they choose to eat. Not necessarily to go from being, you know, a real carnivore to being completely vegetarian, but for being, well, what food critic Michael Pollan once called, you know, the omnivore's dilemma, to be a mindful omnivore or something in between. So I will get up the air and let her comment, but it's something that none of your other callers raised, and I never hear that issue discussed, and it does bother me a lot, and I'd love to hear what she has to say. Yeah. Thanks.
Richard, thank you for your call. Solejo, the opportunity there to talk about, you know, animal farming practices as well.
Right. Yeah. So, of course, you know, the Bay Area is one of the epicenters of that, you know, farm to table and like that consciousness about sourcing and ingredients. And, you know, Michael Pollan does make his home in the Bay Area as well. And I've read The Omnivore's Dilemma. I think I read it in high school. And it was so influential to me and the way I thought about where I got my food. So, yes, it is definitely a part of my consciousness. But I think the best way a critic can do this rather than being didactic, right? Like people don't like being lectured to. They don't like being told what to do, especially with food. Not even me. And the best way to do it is to model that behavior, right? One way is to talk about vegetarian options on menus because mm-hmm. so often those options lack or they're just one and it's just like whatever. But if you really consider, you know, the beauty of a vegetarian diet, like people will gravitate towards it if you tell them it's delicious rather than, you know, if you tell them it's good for the environment or whatever. Like, of course, it's important. But like, you know, at the bottom line, like people want to eat good food.
Yeah.
And if the vegetarian options are good, I will talk about it. And, you know, I think hopefully more people will order those and then there will be a cascade effect.
Yeah. Historically, food critics have valued their anonymity, right? They don't want the restaurant to know that it's them sitting at that table. You know, we've heard stories of wigs and sunglasses and whatever. You're not going to do that, right?
On a practical level, it is too late for me. I've been covered in, you know, radio and magazines and my picture just out there. So that we've crossed the Rubicon on that one. And the other kind of interesting nuance to this is that critics are never purely anonymous. I think that's sort of a misconception that we have as the public. Oftentimes, a restaurant, if they can afford it, will pay for a consultant who will do that sleuthing and find the picture and like dig through social media to find the picture of the critic and print it out. And, you know, they'll paste it in the wall of the office so that if the critic walks in, people will be able to know that person. The interesting, like, other side of my lack of anonymity is that more restaurants can just bypass that middleman and just Google me. I'm right there. And so it makes things a little bit more even, actually.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to David, who's calling from Portland, Maine. David, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I recently was fortunate enough to eat at a restaurant named Prudencia in Bogota, Colombia, where it was very good, but also I was talking to folks who worked there, and they instilled a system that kind of created a quality between the back of the house and the front of the house from a financial, you know, another perspective. And I had any thoughts, love to hear your thoughts. And if something like that, you know, you think might evolve here and, you know, with the folks attempting to pull out, you know, tipping and stuff like that.
Hmm. David, thanks for your call. Soleil, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think that's really fascinating. I was just in Japan too, where, you know, they don't do tipping. They just sort of get paid what they need to get paid to live. And so I think it's a bigger question too about what constitutes a basic income for who. And, you know, there have been a lot of experiments with tipping and not tipping. And I think it's been a really rocky road so far, especially in New York and in California and Minnesota too. There have been places that have tried to do it and just haven't really figured it out because I think culturally it's so ingrained. But I'm excited to see all of the various models of what people are trying, because one thing that I really want to dig into as a critic is just what is a restaurant and what are the things that we must have in a restaurant and what are things that we can evolve past? And, you know, I think because the Bay Area is an area of such dynamism and, you know, strong politics, I think we're going to see a lot of really interesting answers to that question.
Well, I mean, so that it is a very interesting question. Just right now, I mean, what are one of the things you think that we could evolve past in terms of what is a restaurant?
Oh, man. The idea of service is really fascinating to me because, you know, what level of pampering is enough, you know? And what are you paying for as far as your server's behavior and their ability to, you know, for example, like if a patron says something untoward towards a server, will that behavior be condoned by the restaurant or will the patron be kicked out? Like there's all sorts of like nuances, right, to the way people can be treated. But of course, I think the prevailing notion is that a server cannot talk back to a patron because that is just like the ultimate taboo in American restaurant life. So that's really interesting to me. How can we push past that and kind of advocate for employees and workers in the restaurant world?
Hmm. Let's go to Jordan, who's calling from Ottawa, Canada. Jordan, you're on the air.
Good day. My
Jordan, you still there? Looks like we lost Jordan's call. Jordan did speak to our phone screener, Soleil. So I've got a little note here about what Jordan wanted to ask. Jordan wanted to ask if you factor in issues of food waste, that kitchens that Jordan's worked in throw out garbage cans of food every shift, and it's a waste of energy and resources that that can be quite invisible to restaurant patrons. Are you going to take a look at that?
Well, I mean, it'll be hard for me to look in the garbage itself. But I think if I can pick up on a restaurant doing really interesting things with their food waste, I think that's cool. Like if they're serving like fish heads, I think that's really cool. And, you know, there are some restaurants that do that. They like kind of serve the other parts of a fish like once a week and you can try it and it's really interesting, right? Alternately, of course, if you see like, I don't know, breeds of fish or species of fish that aren't so common, right? Like kind of trash fish on a menu. I think that's really worth noting too.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Olivia Lee, who's calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Olivia Lee, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was incensed by the caller, the Dominique person, who owns the restaurant or whatever it was, that he was so motivated by racial bias to say such an awful thing. I worked as a nurse for about 30 years, and there was never anyone who I took care of that was in a life or death situation who cared about whether it was a black person, a white person, a green or orange person taking care of them when they were in a situation where it was important that they lived or died. They didn't care about the race. So I think he should think twice about his comments.
Yeah.
And who's out there in his restaurant?
Oh, Olivia Lee, forgive me for asking, but since this is radio, do you mind if I ask? I mean, are you African-American?
I am.
Okay. I mean, how often, if you've gone out to a restaurant, have you experienced some kind of racism?
I can't recall that there was ever any blatant, outright racism, but there are many times when there are little subtle things that is done to you, you know, like maybe they won't come back to your table, or maybe they won't ask you what your order is, or something very subtle. But once put together, you know that they are things that they're treating you differently than they're treating other customers. So I've never been openly, you know, treated.
Yeah.
Different.
But it doesn't have to be overt for it to be racist, though, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Olivia Lee, thank you so very much for your call. Soleil Ho, we're down to a minute left to go here, and this conversation did not go at all where I expected. But again, I think that's exactly one of the reasons why this new kind of engagement with all the aspects of modern America and how they intersect in restaurants, right? And how and what we eat is so very important. So I just want to give you a chance. We got 30 seconds here for you to give a last thought about, you know, what you see in the future for the kind of food criticism that you want to do and why you think we should be reading it.
Well, I think with this current generation of food writers, there's so many food writers of color out there that I love and respect. And so I'm so excited about our kind of community moving in a direction that is more progressive and just more exciting for everyone.
Yeah. Well, Soleil Ho, incoming restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, joining us today from St. Paul, Minnesota. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you this hour. Thank you so very much. Well, about that caller Dominic and his racist remarks. Dominic claimed he was from Aspen and that he is a vice president at Charthouse Restaurants. You'll remember his call from earlier in the hour. Well, since this program first aired, we contacted Houston, Texas-based Landry's Incorporated, the company that currently owns the Charthouse chain. Steve Scheinthal, Landry's executive vice president and general counsel, told us, quote, "There is no Dominic that is a vice president of Charthouse, and no vice president of Charthouse called Dominic. I don't even know who this Dominic is. This is a horrible hoax. Our organization has zero tolerance for any kind of racism. We take this seriously. It was a horrible statement that does not reflect the views of our organization," end quote. Landry's Incorporated has owned Charthouse since 2002. Scheinthal said that since Landry's acquired the company, there has never been a company officer named Dominic. He is not personally aware of any employee named Dominic. On Point screens its callers to create the most robust hour of live conversation possible, and we do apologize that this hoax got on the air. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.